you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Today we bring you the third episode of Beyond Us, an all-new series made in partnership with Essentia Foundation. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and head over to our website, iai.tv.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond Us series by the Institute of Art and Ideas. My name is Bernardo Kastrup.
And my name is Fred Matzer.
In this series, we are exploring four concepts that underpin and define the modern world: knowledge, competition, language, and growth.
And in each episode, we're joined by a leading thinker to help us, and hopefully you, see each concept in a new light.
This is the third episode of the series, and today we are talking on language. Perhaps the most useful of human faculties, language allows us to communicate vital information about the external world and to organize social interaction. But we often have difficulty using language to convey the inner world of our conscious experience. Here to discuss the nature, uses, and limitations of language with us is renowned British philosopher of language, Jennifer Hornsby. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hello, Bernardo. Hello, Fred. It's good to have been invited to this.
It's a pleasure to have you here, Jennifer, to tackle this big topic. We have a challenge because we are going to be using language to talk about language itself. And we want to make the conversation more general. We want to explore the nature of language, what it is, what it is not, how it relates to human consciousness, how it relates to our worldview. And for the followers of the Beyond Us series, they will know that towards the end of each episode, we like to relate the concept that we are discussing to society at large, to the moment we are living through, and ask ourselves what might the future bring in that regard. So I'll start with a general question that appeals not only to your philosophy expertise, but to your wisdom as an experienced human being. And the question is the following: to what extent is language really a description of an objective reality, of an objective state of affairs? And to what extent does it actually create a sort of linguistic reality tunnel? In other words, a kind of illusion. What do you think about this?
You speak of language as a description? But I think it's a user of language who describes things.
But would the linguistic construct be truly just a description of objective states of affairs? Or is it as much a reflection of that who, or of who that describes the world? In other words, are descriptions in language really objective and neutral? Or do they capture actually a subjective point of view, a sort of idiosyncratic reality tunnel, so to say?
I think of any language as a shared thing. So it's not, as it were, just the speaker who's coming out with some words, who's attaching concepts to what one might call things in the world. So if she says things and thereby applies words to things, I think she's achieved a record of how things are objectively, if you like.
So you don't think that our use of extremely loaded terms, like the first one that comes to my mind is God. There are probably 7.5 billion different definitions of the word God, but we don't preface what we say by attaching our particular definition first. We just use the words as they have meaning to us, and that meaning may not be entirely shared.
Yeah, God, of course, is a difficult case. I mean, I think if I use the word, it depends whom I'm speaking to, quite how I think of the word as being understood. Because what one wants to achieve in communication is a shared understanding. The speaker says it and the hearer hears it, and they now both know what the speaker said. So if I was speaking to a theist, I'm sure I would use the word God on the assumption that it wasn't the case that God didn't exist.
If we listen to the newscast at 8 o'clock, information is conveyed to us in language. Do you think that reflects a more or less objective state of affairs, or is that too highly subjective in essence?
I hope so. I mean, it'll depend a bit on what news channel I might be listening to, whether I'm prepared to think that I'm learning how things are in some other part of the world, what happened yesterday in Parliament, as it might be. But I don't know what hangs on calling those things objective parts of the world. I mean, I think if this is what actually happened in Parliament and that's what I'm told on the news, then I've come to know something that I didn't know before. If I'm told that in Myanmar, such and such is happening now because they might have a reporter there, then I think I learned something even about the present.
I'll share with you my own impression, and I'll be glad to hear your commentary on it. Sometimes I am scared that our worldview, things that we take to be objective facts about reality out there, what reality is, how it behaves, our relationship with it, may reflect a lot more our own linguistic patterns of thinking and the linguistic structure of the way we think about the world. It can reflect as much about that as it may reflect a objective state of affairs like that. And every now and then I get caught with this, oh my God, I think this goes further than I would ever dare admit that that we are living in linguistic reality tunnels, so to say, which are given by what we tell ourselves in inner language regarding the nature of the world and the states of affairs out there. Have you ever had an impression like that, that you suddenly get caught off guard?
I don't think I share your fear. But I mean, that's partly because I think that language is that which is something I share with others, as it were. So it's not as though there's me and my language and it confronts this world. And maybe it doesn't confront it in quite the way that I'd always hoped, not sharing your fear, as it were.
I'm sure Freddie will try to, we want to take you more to the subjective side of things, you know, descriptions of inner states of affairs, like our inner feelings. But before we go there, I don't want to insist too much and beat a dead horse, but there have been studies showing, for instance, that our perception of colors may be highly influenced by the words we have to express the differences between colors. So if your language has a richer color palette in words, then you see more colors, or the other way around. Like that, there are studies on a tribe in Africa that the tribe is able to discern a lot more subtle differences in green than Westerners are, and so happens that their language has a lot more words for green than our language has. So would this suggest some sort of linguistic loading even in our perceptions themselves, or you don't give credibility to this kind of studies?
Because as grown-ups we've all learnt some particular human language. Some of us are lucky enough to have learnt two, as it were, and we make use of such concepts as we've acquired by virtue of learning language and living in the world in which this language is used. And maybe the fact that we failed to learn the concepts which people who can distinguish many shades of green and have words for each of them have learnt. But I don't think that's a handicap to their knowing whether something is green, as we would use it in English.
Yeah, so what you're saying, Jennifer, is also when you don't know about it, you don't miss it. And it only becomes clear when a person that has that nuances in language and in observation, in this case in colors, that it cannot be shared on the level with the other person that doesn't know it. But perhaps by knowing it, can learn it. No, indeed, many of us feel that language can't do justice to the inner world of consciousness. And the question is, do we simply need better words and sentences, or will this always be impossible? What do you think?
I suppose I'm not inclined to think of consciousness as an inner world, as if it were kind of something separable from the world of which we think we speak. I may be differ from many philosophers in thinking this. I know some philosophers think that we could give a material description of a person, and that wouldn't account for the fact of her being conscious. So we've got to add something in order to say what consciousness is. But, you know, I think there are human beings and they are conscious, as it were. And that's just a fact about a speaker, that she's conscious usually of what she's saying. Mm-hmm. So I don't think of consciousness as attaching to an inner world. I should say, I'm not attending to something that Bernardo said earlier, which was connected with knowledge specifically of oneself, because I'm thinking, as it were, I'm conscious of the world around me. I can tell you what's here. I'll be conscious in so saying. I'll assume that you consciously hear what I say. That, of course, doesn't speak to the specific question of what one knows of oneself, which perhaps one's particularly inclined to think of as inner.
Is it more difficult, you think, to establish commonality of meaning and intent when it comes to our inner world? Because when it comes to objective facts out there, like if I invent a word for a house, like the word house, we can establish commonality of meaning by pointing to the house and saying, that's what we mean by house. But if you're feeling in a very particular way, it's difficult to point at that and say, this is what I mean by the word sadness or despair. We have those words, but isn't it more difficult to establish this commonality of meaning when it comes to our own private inner feelings?
Yeah, you spoke of yourself as inventing the word house. I deny that you invented it. I know what it means. It's, you know, it's a word of English which you used. And I think there's a tendency to think concerning any word that someone might at some point have stipulated what it means, as it were. So a house means something which people, blah, 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 blah. They see that people, blah, 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 blah. So, and I'm going to call that a house. But that seems to me just wrong. I mean, you know, we grow up in the language which is spoken around us, spoken probably by our parents and carers and others around us. And insofar as we know what words mean, it's because we've come to know what they mean through this process of acquiring language.
So words emerge, they are not merely defined.
They're not merely defined. I suppose that's one thing I'm saying, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, which isn't to say that you can't, for some words, want to give a definition of it. And someone who didn't know what a word meant, if they were fluent in language, you could use other words to enable them to understand now what this word, which they hadn't previously heard, had meant and continues to mean.
Which brings me to a topic pretty prevalent in society today. In the world of, you know, alternative facts and fake news, when we hear people talking or saying something, so often we sort of zoom into the words. We analyze what the person said. And may we lose from sight when we do that, what the person actually meant. In other words, what is more important, what has been said or the intention behind those words? I know that when I'm talking to my girlfriend, I'm always looking for what she means. But when it comes to you know, the social games at large, politics, economics, the news, we zoom into words. Could language be misleading in that regard as a sort of a layer which expresses meaning but also distorts meaning?
I should say first, I don't think there are alternative facts, as it were. So I think at least so far as what we're apt to think of as factual language is concerned. We can use sentences which state facts, or if we lie, we might use a sentence which precisely doesn't state a fact. So I'm not, I don't think I scrutinize the news, for instance, to determine whether there might be some alternative facts in here. I mean, I like to think I rely on reliable sources and that by and large, what I learn are the facts as they are. But you're talking about private conversations. You want to know what your girlfriend means. And yeah. I take it that ordinarily she, like anyone else, in the first instance, means what she says, as it were. But there's more to it than that. I mean, why should she be saying this? So there may be something which led her to say what she did, which it's important for you, as her boyfriend, to come to know.
I think what I'm trying to get at is, what are the limitations of language? Do we make too much of what is said as opposed to what is meant? Can language really describe the full gamut of our inner experience? Can language even describe objective states of affairs? In other words, I'm questioning the perfection of the tool. But the sense I get from you is almost that language isn't even a tool. It isn't even invented. It is one with objective states of affairs. Would that be fair to say? If that's what you think, I would ask you then, what makes you come to this rather absolute conclusion?
I think nobody knows the origins of the first human language, or would know actually what to say about whether such and such in human history, if they could even know it, constituted the first human language. But I'm thinking of language as you and I know it, and we're both users of it. It does seem as though you're, what's different between us is my insistence that language is shared, that, you know, I don't have a language all on my own, nor does your girlfriend have a language all on her own. And you said actually at the very beginning, we're going to have to use language to talk about language. Well, actually, there's nothing else that we can talk with. I mean, of course, we can express our feelings for people other than by talking. But if we're going to talk, then it's language that we have to use. And for the most part, we have conversations with people who share our language and us who understand what we say as we mean it. I mean, there can be many, many hiccups, but...
I see where you're coming from. I think my view is colored by my own experience. I'm forced to think daily in three languages, and I often catch myself thinking about the same thing differently, depending on in which language I'm thinking. So my thinking reflects the structure of language. In the Dutch language, objects tend to come first, and verbs go out to the end. So it forces me to think through the complete thing I'm trying to get at before I say the first word. In English, the verbs come first, so you can immediately start saying something before you thought it through to the end. And then Portuguese is again differently. It's a language that has a lot more synonymous words, but more nuanced. So I see that happening myself. But if I can ask this question more precisely, are you with Noam Chomsky that language reflects a universal grammar that is encoded in our genes, that we don't really invent it, that language is a reflection of how we think and how we have to think because we are human beings?
There's an extent to which I agree with Chomsky, which I think possibly you don't agree with him about. I am apt to think that it's a characteristic of human children that they will acquire the language of those around them, as it were, and which Chomsky will put by saying there's an innate language module or whatever. He seems to think that this has a universality, which I might want to deny attaches to it, because I think, I mean, they acquire the language of those around them, But of course, the language of those around them has been formed because it's it existed for many years in the context of the social practices of those around them, which might be quite different from the social practices of a typical person in the UK who speaks English. So I think there are things that Chomsky's apt to say which I would disagree with, but I think the sort of innatism in Chomsky is something I sort of agree with, and perhaps you don't.
No, I actually agree with him. I think there is a universality to the structure of our thinking, and I do think we think in linguistic terms by using concepts, symbols, and grammatical structures to weave those together in a sort of inner narrative. And I even think that we often confuse reality with our own inner narrative without even knowing that you're confusing those. But maybe I'll ask Fred. Fred, any comments?
Yeah, I'm thinking what we started with, that Jennifer said, that language is there to share with others. And I always say it's sharing of information, everything that expresses itself in form or that we can be connected with through with our senses. And so it can be used in an authentic, honest way to express our thoughts and feelings, because it's not only thoughts that we are connected with, but also that what coincides, what goes through the not rational part, but informs us, for example, through feelings, which is not so. If we look at language and we look at sharing and sharing information, language is part of it, but it's also the smell, it are gestures of the others. So it's one of the ways to bridge or to disbridge or to disconnect. So yeah, and often I think, but this is not part of the conversation, at a very early stage, we were babies. We didn't have language, and we still were in contact with our parents or other babies, and we could just smell an apple without knowing the concept of an apple. We know how the color was, how it smelled, how it felt, and things like that. So that often brings me to the question, at what level does it serve us? Isn't language sometimes a little bit too dominant over other ways of information exchange? Because when I connect with a baby or even with a dog, you know, or also with a dog, I can go more or less to the heart of the dog by connecting my own heart. And then it is beyond language. So, yeah, this is just not a question. Perhaps it is a question. It's more a reflection that I'm getting now.
Yeah, I think the question that comes to me when you said that is there a world beyond language? In the sense that a world that cannot be described in language?
I think I'm tempted to answer that question as you put it, no. I mean, I fail to know what the world is when it's something indescribable. I mean, philosophers have very different ways of using the phrase the world. I'm apt to think the world is that wherein we all live, and indeed our dogs and all other living things live.
But is there anything to that world that cannot be said and yet is the case?
People sometimes struggle to say things. There's something that they'd like to say and find it impossible to say. I don't deny that that's a possible phenomenon.
But you think those things are describable, at least in principle?
Maybe that one experiences emotions and has to give up, as it were, trying to formulate exactly how one feels using language. I mean, I should say, this is in response, I think, to something Fred said. I don't think language stands alone. I mean, if you're a student of language or linguistics or philosophy of language or whatever, you take this phenomenon of exchange of information, then realize a whole lot more can go on than simply exchange of information. Commands can be given, et cetera, feelings expressed. But of course, that's never all that's going on when language is used. Yeah. I mean, I was very struck by this actually by reading the Norwegian Knausgård. He was giving an account of what went on at Hitler's campaign rallies, as it were. And his thought was that actually what was said, if you see what I mean, if you transcribed it, was more or less irrelevant to what was going on. I mean, what he was doing was whipping up emotions in order that people should think that there was a better world without politics, free from the usual constraints of rationality, etc., etc. And that was what they found immensely attractive. And that was how he came to have so much power. So this was the suggestion. I mean, I don't know anything about it. It was written in the context of thinking about what Trump might have done on the 6th of February. That's why there was this discussion. But I'm sure he got something right. So as it were, language was being used, but much more was going on than one could possibly know about by reading the words that were said.
But those goings on were still, in principle, describable by language, you would say.
I actually looked up a bit of the Knausgård, and I think he thought that what was going on escaped analysis. So he was able to tell one, as it were, the state of mind in which those listening to a National Socialist campaigner, the state of mind that people listening to such a one came to be in. And of course he used words, but it isn't as though those were the words that were being used by the person who was putting them into their state of mind.
Yeah, I get you. Regarding your own theory of action, Jennifer, you make an argument that to me is eminently linguistic. And the point I try to make is that actions are not just bodily movement, right? Actions take place underneath the skin, so to say. And your argument for that is based on the idea of transitive and intransitive verbs. Is that incorrect, what I just said?
No, I think, just as I've said, we use language in the world. I think we act in the world. And it would be perfectly wrong to think that we had even started on the count of action by saying actions are bodily movements. Though, of course, philosophers who are interested in philosophy of action think they're interested in, as they might put it, mental physical connections. So bodily movement comes to the fore, because when one's acting, one's body's up to something, not, so to speak, just one's mind. But not that that's necessarily a good way of thinking about it, but it explains why a philosopher might say all actions are bodily movements, as indeed some philosophers have.
But that was precisely my point. The question is a much broader, almost metaphysical question, right? Are actions an external reflection of inner intent or not? And what strikes me was, at least in the first Jennifer went about it with a linguistic argument to address what was in principle a metaphysical question. And that to me was very striking, because it seemed to put language at the very forefront of a worldview. But would you say you departed from that?
Yeah. I mean, I was earlier meaning to question your use of inner consciousness, as it were. And of course I can intend to do something or other, and there's nothing outward to show for it. But I think as long as I'm actually doing something, I mean, I may be doing something trivial like drinking a cup of coffee or making a telephone call, I think my intention is, so to speak, therein. It's outer. What I'm doing intentionally.
If I can't resist this, I have to ask you this. The original Wittgenstein would, adopt the correspondence theory of truth, right? I mean, you can make statements, and if those statements correspond to external states of affairs, then those statements are correct. Otherwise, they're not correct. The later Wittgenstein basically said all philosophy is just language games. All philosophical problems are language problems. They have no objective existence. They don't need to be solved. They are not out there. It's stuff we make up with our use of words. How would you see the present Jennifer, the mature Jennifer, in relation to that change in Wittgenstein's view of philosophical problems and language?
Yeah, I think the early Wittgenstein, the one who wrote the Tractatus, was interested in symbolic systems.
Right.
Whereas the later Wittgenstein, and you've used the notion of the language game, was interested in language as we actually know it. So if I wanted to say stuff in philosophy of language, I'd be much more likely to want to say such things as the later Wittgenstein, the one who, of the investigations, said.
But then wouldn't that imply that the meaning of every word is dependent on the meaning of other words, which sort of relativizes language completely and makes it difficult to say whether language can actually capture objective facts? That the meaning of what you say is dependent on the meaning of the other words involved in the game. They are not absolute, they are relative. They depend on that network of interrelated meanings. To me, my interpretation, and I'm the first to admit that my interpretation can be completely wrong because I'm not really a Wittgenstein scholar, but what the contrast I see between my understanding of what Wittgenstein meant there and what I picked up from you today is that you seem to attribute more definite meaning to words as opposed to a relative meaning, the meaning they have when they are included in a network, in a web of words that give each other relative meaning.
Yeah, I don't know that I want to speak of relative meaning, but I think one should think, as I guess Wittgenstein wanted to think of language as a whole in trying to say something about the playing of language games, as he put it.
Yeah, necessarily.
One at a time. I mean, I think if I talked about the meaning of words earlier, it was because you were asking me questions about that. And I don't think it's wrong to say concerning any particular word that it has some meaning. Ordinarily, one can say what a word means easily enough. Sometimes if someone doesn't know the meaning, one has to resort to other words to explain the meaning. But I don't think that that makes the meaning relative, as it were.
So you do attribute to words a definite, I will use the word absolute, but I don't mean it in a super metaphysical sense. I just mean it as non-relative. You do think our words have non-relative meaning. So they do capture an objective state of affairs. Whether it's true or not can be verified, but our words don't depend on the implicit words we have in the networks of meaning in our own minds. Like what I may mean by God depends on what I mean by a number of other words, like transcendence, spirit, matter, causality. All that gives relative meaning to the word God as I use it, or in the context I use it. But you would say, well, words beyond that should have very well-grounded, definite meaning. Fred?
No, I think, is there any way a objective reality? Aren't we all people that live in a different place, in a different time? And we look at it from a perspective. And we can, if we sit at one side of the table, we might have a kind of same idea about what we saw. Even then, our observation may be handicapped because one person may have fever and the other person is sneezing. So it is very, I think I've always struggled with the idea of what is objective. The more precise you go into details, the more difficult it is to see what is common ground in objectivity. So but Jennifer, something comes up. You being an expert on words, I realize that we humans are one of the millions of forms of expression on this planet, and as I think to know, we are the only ones that help our communication to do it as well in words. But in when it relates to information exchange, but ants, bees, trees, dogs or birds, or they all communicate all the time with one another without words. They share information fields. So we are quite an exemption. And that comes sometimes to the thought, how would it be if we keep on behaving like babies and not use words? Of course, it's a rather abstract question, but it was just an idea that comes up right now.
I think it's characteristic of human beings to be language users. And I think that goes in hand with their the kinds of knowledge that they can have, as it were. For instance, of the past. I mean, think how much we know by virtue of being able to say what happened.
That's unique,
I mean, I think we are very much unique as a species. But we're not unique in some sense communicating. Come by bits of information because others have done something by virtue of which they know it.
I'll ask you a more concrete question. What can philosophy tell us about the darker side of language? How it can be used to lie, mislead, and manipulate people? What do you think about that?
It's sometimes, I mean, in recent years, it's come to amaze me how ready people are to believe what they hear when manifestly, as far as I'm concerned, what they hear is simply a lie. And I think there are all kinds of ways, actually, not simply by lying, that language is implicated in what people at large come to know, say within a political system. Mm-hmm. So I was actually reading something recently about someone who talked about his experience as a politician. He's now, he was a member of the Conservative Party, and I'm sure he's still a member, but now no longer is any sort of minister. But he was saying that what went on in discussion was a failure to say what was obvious, because there were obvious things which needed to be brought into the discussion, when one would have thought needed, but they didn't want those things to be known.
Yeah.
I think there are all kinds of ways in which language can be used, specifically perhaps by politicians, to manipulate what's known by the community. But I don't think I need to be a philosopher to be in a position to see that that goes on.
Do you think we think in language, Jennifer? Is there a tight relationship, you think, between grammatical, syntactical structures and the way we reason and we think about things?
Yeah, I think we're language users and we're concept-using creatures, as it were. There's then a question how one uses the word thought, because some of the things Fred was asking me were requiring me to think of animals as thinkers. And I think one does have to think, as it were, that they do things because things are thus and so. And of course, if I'm human, I can say how things were, which led me to do such and such. So there's use of the word thought, so that it's very hard not to attach it to animals. Nonetheless, I think ordinarily we think of, when we think of thought, we think of human thought. We think you can't have such thought, save that you're human, that's to say a language user.
We know, Jennifer, that language sort of evolves, right? I mean, English today is totally different than 9th century English, to the point that no English speaker today would have any idea of 9th century English. It was completely different, and that happens in all languages. Where do you see language going in the future? How will it evolve? And how do you think that will impact our way of life, our worldview, how we interact with one another? Is there interplay there? And if there is, where do you see this going long term?
I mean, I'm sure language will change. And I think actually, at least if one's thinking about English, new words, as they're called, things which dictionary makers have to add to their dictionaries, get added at a rate that they never would have done, say 50 years ago. So I'm sure that the evolution of language, which presumably goes hand in hand with the evolution of stuff that people find themselves needing to want to say, is increasing apace, as it were. But quite where it's leading, I don't know.
And do you think there is a correlation between that evolution and how society itself evolves, our values, our ways of interacting with one another?
I think if words which are derogatory of groups of people were eliminated from the language, we'd live in a better world. But of course, I don't see how it could be that those words came to be eliminated, except that there weren't groups of people who, for instance, were racist.
So we could progress, but there are many variables at play here, and we can't wrestle control over the future evolution of language and society. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today. I wish we had more time, but we have to leave it here today. We are very grateful for your participation, and maybe we look forward to speaking to you again another time in the future. Thanks a lot.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you also to Fred.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. We will be back in a few weeks with episode 4 on growth. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. Remember to like, subscribe, and review wherever you listen. And tune in next week for more big ideas from the world's leading thinkers.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.